Our next presentation is by Michael Provence. The name of his topic, Middle Eastern Wars and Humanitarian Catastrophes, the Role of U.S. Middle East Policy in Recent History. Michael.
Thank you for coming. And I'd like to thank Joy and Patrice for organizing this panel once again. I'm actually going to talk about refugees from Middle Eastern wars. I am a historian. I teach history at UC San Diego here, so I'm a bit out of place, and I hope you'll indulge me for my historian's foibles and idiosyncrasies. Refugees. The three refugee crises that I want to talk about are the First World War, quickly, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict of 1948, and the current refugee crisis caused by the Iraq War since 2003. And the topic, the title that Joy mentioned, Middle Eastern Wars and Humanitarian Catastrophes, I want to, if I had to do over again, I would emphasize refugees in this title, actually. And along those lines, I'd like to tell a very quick story here about a refugee of my acquaintance. Some 10 years ago, I jumped into a cab in Damascus, and the gentleman, the cab driver, said, "Ahlan wa sahlan, welcome here." He knew I was a foreigner. He said, "So, where are you from?" I said, "I'm from America." He said, "Me? I'm a Palestinian refugee, and I have a bone to pick with you." And I said, "Please." He said, "I'm a refugee. I live in the camp, in the refugee camp outside of Damascus. And my daughter attends a UN-funded schools, a school, as do all Palestinian refugees in Syria and Lebanon. And her school closed, and she can't go to school, and I can't afford to send her to another school." And I said, "Well, it's terrible." He said, "Well, it's your fault, actually." And I said, "Well, how so?" And he said, "Well, your Senator Helms refuses to pay the UN dues. And for this reason, my daughter's school is not funded. And so her school is closed, and she's not getting an education, and it's your fault." And I said, "Well, I think it's terrible, but I can't do anything about it." And he said, "Well, he's a senator from your country. You can do something about it." And I said, "Well, he's not a senator from my state." And he said, "Well, North Carolina, right?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, where are you from?" I said, "I live in Illinois now." He said, "You can move there." So the point of this story is that U.S. policies do have an effect on refugee crises, although, of course, the crisis since 2003, which is the second most acute, perhaps most acute refugee crisis in Middle Eastern history, is entirely the responsibility of the United States and U.S. citizens, full stop. Now, the photograph or the image here depicts the last Ottoman Sultan, or one of the last Ottoman Sultans, worrying over the end of Ottoman rule in the Balkans in the early part of the last century. And this led to humanitarian crises and refugee flows into towns and villages of what is today Syria and Turkey. And there are villages in those places now where people, for example, speak Greek because they are refugees from, in this case, he's moaning the loss of Crete. There are Cretan villages until today in Syria, for example. But the greatest refugee crisis and the greatest humanitarian catastrophe in Middle Eastern history is actually the First World War, during which mobilization and war killed millions and millions of people, and the population of Anatolia, what is today Turkey, and Greater Syria, what is today Syria, Lebanon, Israel, and Jordan, the population mortality was approximately 30% due to the war, mobilization, and the famine that followed. Many people have heard of these are soldiers, prisoners taken in Palestine being marched by the British. Many people have heard of the Armenian genocide, the death march of Armenians out of Ottoman territory. The British and the French blockaded the ports of the Eastern Mediterranean, and there was a famine that affected all of the people of the region, actually. And then, of course, the war was followed by a British and French partition of the region, which led to countless conflicts, all conflicts, really, since that time. This should make us cautious about advocating partition of other people's countries, I think, as a recipe for adjudicating disputes, usually caused by outsiders. Some 1.5 or 2 million Greek-speaking Muslims were expelled from Europe, and probably a million, well, and a similar quantity of Turkish-speaking Christians were expelled from Anatolia in the wake of the war. Now, these people didn't want to leave, but this population transfer was adjudicated by the new League of Nations. And, of course, they were strangers in the places that they went. They were defined by their sectarian identity, not by ties or ethnicity or linguistic reasons, but only because of their religion. And it seems, if we look at this situation over 100 years, that one of the purposes of international organizations is actually to validate the shifting of borders and the movement of populations by war. Or in order to sort of, you know, put the final stamp on these transfers. Now, of course, the population, the refugee crisis that most of us are most familiar with is the result of the 1948 war for Palestine, the Israeli War of Independence, or the Nakba, as it's called among the Arabs. This population transfer of, that's World War I, led 700,000 people to be in the finely calculated expression used by historians to flee or to be expelled from their homes in what had been British Mandatory Palestine between about mid-1947 and mid-1948. These people became refugees in the surrounding countries, and most of them are there until today. The United Nations immediately set up, one of the first jobs of the United Nations was to set up feeding programs. The tents, of course, this is Nahr al-Barad in northern Lebanon in 1950. The tents were provided by the UN. Education was provided by the UN. Obviously, the women there are providing the water themselves, as you can see. But they became completely under the care of the United Nations Relief and Works Organization, which was founded at that time, and were the people running the school of the taxi driver I met in Damascus. Now, today, that population is about 4 million, and despite a series of UN resolutions immediately and since then, they have not been repatriated or compensated in any fashion by any country. In some cases, they have been absorbed to a lesser or greater degree into the countries where they have come to live. The least bit of integration into Lebanon, coincidentally. It's not coincidentally. This is the same camp in 2007 after a war which is actually linked to the Iraq conflict in ways that are unbelievable and mind-boggling, but we'd have to talk about that. But this is the camp pictured in the previous slide, Nahr al-Barad in Lebanon. Other refugees followed from the conflicts between Israel and the Arab countries. But in the overall scheme of things, and since 2003, these refugee flows and catastrophes have actually been dwarfed by the scale of the Iraq War. This is America, and we do things bigger, and our catastrophes are bigger, apparently. It's not really, you'll excuse me for a very lame joke.
I like it.
So, since the Iraq War, a huge proportion of the population has been displaced. The Iraqi population in 2003 was approximately 25 million people. And some 20% of this population, or sorry, I should say, yeah, about 20% of this population has been displaced and are now refugees. About 3 million internally displaced, or approximately 3 million internally displaced, and about somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 million actually refugees in surrounding countries. In some cases also under the protection of the UN. Now, the countries that they have mostly gone to are Syria and Jordan. The Syrians have, for reasons having to do with the ideology of the government and long practice, the Syrian government did not require visas of other Arab citizens. That's changed, and so it's more difficult for refugees to reach Syria now. Jordan always required visas, and for the most part, it was well-to-do people who were able to get these visas and to go to Jordan. But people who were walking and carrying everything and more destitute went to Damascus, went to Syria. Now, it's notable, of course, that Syria is a kind of an adjunct of the axis of evil. And so while it's a country that's quite poor, it's shouldered a tremendous amount of this responsibility of feeding and caring for these people, not at a very high level, it must be pointed out, but with no assistance whatsoever from the United States. Now, one of the reasons that people have been forced to leave is because of the sectarian conflicts that have, besides the war itself, also sectarian conflict within Iraq. And as Wael pointed out a few minutes ago, I would like to sort of give a very brief genealogy of sectarian conflict in Iraq. When the United States invaded, as had done the French and the British during their colonial experience, the political consciousness of the people involved was beyond contemplation by the invading forces. That is to say that they considered that the existing political structures, social structures, were irredeemable and not even worth investigating. And so the population was broken down into its sectarian essentials by the ideology of the invaders. To do something else would require grappling with the consciousness and the humanity of the people in a way that was not actually possible for the invaders. And so the governing party of Saddam became the Sunni Ba'ath Party, which is a kind of a crazy distortion because, of course, it was a secular nationalist party started in Syria by a Christian. Never mind. So the Sunni Ba'ath Party became the enemy. And the Sunnis became the enemy. And the Shi, because presumably the Sunni Ba'ath Party had oppressed the Shi, they became our friends. And so the friends of the coalition. And so they were armed and elevated. And the Kurds were better friends. And so they were armed and elevated. And this, of course, led to a guaranteed outbreak of sectarian conflict and a kind of a decrease in the level of political consciousness there, to its essences in a way. This is precisely what happened in Lebanon, and it's precisely the reason that the French had their last census under French rule in 1932, because this justified the French presence in Lebanon at that time. So when people in the region see Iraq today, many people think Lebanon in 1940, and of course the experience of Lebanon has been exceedingly tragic since that time. Now, I want to say a couple of more things here before I finish things up. The United States has not played a constructive role in caring for these refugees. The UN dues are generally paid more expeditiously than they were when Senator Helms was in the Senate, but it's a pittance, actually, particularly when compared with things like the expense of the Lebanon War of 2006, which, of course, was paid for by U.S. taxpayers, actually. The mine clearing is also paid by U.S. taxpayers, and of course the cluster bombs were, of course, made here in the United States as well. The United States accepted 734 Iraqi asylum applications in 2007 out of a population of nearly 5 million refugees. The Swedes accepted 18,000 that year, and Britain accepted 2,000. Now, there's a possibility that 10,000 asylum applications will be accepted this year in the United States. The trouble is, of course, that the refugees have to be interviewed. They have to be vetted, actually. And they can't be vetted in Syria because we don't have diplomatic relations at a high level with Syria because it's an adjunct of the Axis of Evil. So this is a kind of a structural problem that apparently is impossible for the government to actually deal with. Now, I had a conversation with Greg Pappas, who was here earlier and gave this splendid, this wonderful presentation on Pakistan. And Greg pointed out to me in a very gentle way that historians don't ever talk about fixing anything, and that physicians always have to deal with fixing things. And so in honor of Greg, who's not here now, I want to say a few things about that. You know, it's a criticism that historians hear a lot, and it usually doesn't sting very much. You know, you always tell us what's wrong. You never tell us what we should do about it. But in this group, it actually does sting, and so I'm going to. Now, knowledge and action, this is really quite wonderful, and it goes right to the situation in Iraq, it seems to me, has to be fixed by Iraqis. And it's not appropriate or useful for anyone, most particularly Americans, to talk about things like partition or anything that can be imposed on or given to the Iraqis in order to fix the situation there. And there's no reason to believe, actually, that the United States has the capacity or the capability or the wisdom to do anything for any Iraqi in Iraq or in the surrounding countries. Or anywhere. And so the first thing, it seems to me, that in order to begin to repair this dreadful, unspeakable tragedy is for the U.S. United States to leave Iraq and to facilitate or perhaps reparations or something that can be done in order to compensate and to make financial resources available for this huge mass of displaced humanity, and I think it's not a big thing. It's a small thing, actually. It's a pittance. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. We don't have much time, but people can stay later. The panel can stay later, and if you have comments and questions, we'll start now, and let's just keep going. Yes.
Sort of the response to, well, we, excuse my language, we fucked it up over there.
of not just making a mistake, but I better look around because I need to go back to the sort of what I'm going to be up for besides getting out of the way and maybe getting money, I guess. If not. Yeah, sorry.
Hi, my name is Nicole Sprung, and I work here in the refugee clinic in Indigo. And I was wondering if either of you could speak to the change in numbers that we're seeing in Iraqi refugees coming. I think the last count in the States was 13,000 this year in 2008 as of October, and here in San Diego County we're getting around 3,000. And I'm wondering what's causing this change this year, and what's the driver behind that?
Well, I think the media reports that there's been a lot of pressure on the U.S. by the world bodies that, you know, you've caused this and you're not accepting more than 700 last year. And there was a sudden shift saying, okay, we'll accept 8,000 to 10,000, and they will give priority to anybody who cooperated with the occupation, or who was a translator or interpreter and so on, but then other people are getting in. And I know some of the cases, it's a terrible situation also, because they are selecting mostly people with some education background, doctors, PhDs and whatever. They've been promised here everything. They come here and then they go and beg afterwards. They come to the Muslim community asking for help, so it's and some of them went back. I know a few physicians who actually went back and said, I'd rather stay in a refugee place in Jordan, Syria, rather than the simulation here, and it's of course very much more expensive, and they get only, I think, 7 months of stipends and then.
People in the State Department, like Crawford, the ambassador, wrote a. He was very irritated and upset, and gave testimony and did stuff like this, and sort of went to Washington and shamed people about this issue. I mean, you know, he's no hero. Well, I mean, but it's actually partly because of individual action by individual Foreign Service officers, career Foreign Service officers, in the State Department in Iraq, that counts for the increase.
My name is Sonia, I'm a student at San Diego, and going from the point that we heard before, this is open to the whole panel, given the fact that elections are a week from today, what are your views on, and the Iraq war is such a big issue on the ballot, what are your thoughts on the future?
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, repeat the question.
Okay.
Given that the election is one less than a week away, how do you feel the outcome of that election, since Iraq war has been a component of both sides of the political spectrum? What do you see happening with the result of the election?
So I'm from Canada, so I can. We're from Canada, so anyway, I'll just be very brief because I'm not all that well informed. But it just appears to me that Obama has not been very clear about how he would effectively deal with the situation, and I'm disappointed.
And he doesn't have a different policy when it comes to Israel and the Palestinians than Palestine, so that's very good.
If I may kind of have an insight on from at least an Iraqi perspective about the election. For Iraqis, they don't think it will make a difference. They believe that there is bad and there is worse. So probably everybody thinks that McCain is worse. They also are. And I read the media there, after he selected Joe Biden, there was a big outcry, okay, here's the architect of the division of Iraq into three states, and he passed actually a Senate bill on that. So it's as drawing troops is something I think is welcomed by everybody there. But I don't know if he's going to follow through or what is the policy about that. But for sure, McCain has a clear strategy of staying the course and building long-term bases and escalating the military situation. That's for sure.
Yep.
So in the primaries, Senator Obama said that he's going to put up our troops on draft. Then after that, he said that I'm going to discuss that with General Petraeus, and I will, quote unquote, refine my position. So he's pulling that to refine. But I have a question for you about the new treaty which United States will assign in Turkey, and she might have taken that so far. Is there a dispute that will be
repeated?
The question is whether the treaty, which is not getting any coverage at all, actually, is very interesting. Whether the treaty will be imposed on Iraq? No, it won't be. And the Iraqi politicians who are wondering now, I think, and I see Webb's thoughts on this, are realizing that this will come to an end. Not tomorrow, but it will come to an end. And they will still be there. And so, in this situation, and no one will do anything. No one will cross the street no one will stop to cross the street to help George Bush. And so, no, there will not be a treaty between the Iraqis and the Americans in the new world. The Iraqi politicians will stall, and it's in their interest to stall. But the thing is that the U.S. presence in Iraq is valid, is legalized by UN mandate, which expires in 2 months. 2 months. And then there's no legal basis for the United States to be in Iraq. And the treaty is the only way that presence can be legalized. And they have no interest and no reason to give that to Bush. Now, maybe they'll give it to a new president, but I mean, there's outrageous things in it as far as the jurisdiction of, I mean, American troops are immune from Iraqi laws. So, in all cases, for anything. And the oil revenues of the country, the oil resources of the country, they have not convinced themselves that Iraqi oil will not be privatized and given, actually, or sold to American oil companies. They haven't yet. The administration and the political class in this country has not yet jettisoned that idea. And they haven't yet jettisoned the idea of permanent bases in Iraq in perpetuity. And so the Iraqis can't accept any of these things. No Iraqi politician can accept any of these things. Unless, you know, he's given $1 billion in a Swiss passport. Otherwise, forget it. So, your question is a wonderful question. No one's paying attention.
I mean, this is politics in the Middle East is too complex for even somebody who's an insider, and let alone somebody like Bush. So the thing is, what's going on now about this, what you call it, the agreement, or is there's a lot of power behind who's doing what. So there's a major issue of Iran and what's going on, and I think the media is not aware of it. So here's what's going on. Obama promised to have dialogue with Iran, okay? Iran is against this agreement. However, Iran signaled to the Iraqi politicians who were well-fed and raised in Iran, so they're really, their allegiance is to Iran, one, Iraq is number two. They were told, okay, stall on this, not sign it, we'll make a deal swap with Obama, okay? You lay off on this, we'll let the politicians in Iraq make a deal with the U.S. And that's really what's going on behind the scene. And I think this is what's going to happen. If Obama comes and gives some assurances to Iran, then the Iraqi politicians who fear or love Iran, whatever it is, will abide. terms are used and twisted. What is terrorism? Nobody knows what it's at. You know, is fighting for the freedom of your country terrorism? That's what, according to the Bush administration, is. And the same thing with torture. There was a nice documentary I followed on PBS, maybe some of you saw it, that actually the torture was condoned by Rumsfeld and the People Talk, and it was legally put in a document that you can do this as torture. While everything was going on in the media and the Congress, while on the vaccine, this is what's going on in terms of. And then after Rumsfeld gone, or in the last days, seems things changed a bit, but the issue is still there. I think the torture is still accepted by this administration and will continue, and the actual repression that Guantanamo will not be closed as long as this administration is. It's just proof that this is the way we want to do it. So your first question, I missed about the human rights. I don't know if there are any human rights.
Any other comments? Yes. Go ahead.
I live in Jordan right now, but I'm involved in but is there any way that the two of you, regardless of who becomes the next president, could get on their advisory team? I mean, I think it's really important how the historical, you know, and someone who's lived through and knows what's going on behind the scenes, you can get a group of people together.
Well, maybe you can help us. It's great to pick up a phone and be of the campaign of Obama and tell him.
It's very flattering. I figure they know what I think anyway because I'm sure my phone's are ready.
Well, thank you very much for coming. Anyone who wants to continue the discussion, please come on up front and look forward to seeing you in Philadelphia next year.
So the Lebanese are not paying to get that information.
Well,
the resolutions about Israel and Palestine, and the U.S. opposes those resolutions all the time, right? They're one of the four countries, I think. But, I mean, that's part of it. That's why Israel can refuse, right? Because they know the U.S. isn't going to do anything about it.
So, I mean, so it's the U.N. with Lebanon approaching Israel towards information. Absolutely flatly. You know,
yes, give me your contact.
Hard to see what the military interest is at this point.
Okay. I'll write this here. So you're trying to help along with your colleague in a way.
We're just so lucky that we didn't end up in Iraq. You know?
Somebody,
Canada didn't end up in Iraq. Oh, we are
Canada.
So lucky. I mean,
it's problematic when in Afghanistan.
No.
With no end in sight there, but I mean, at least we stayed out of Iraq.
Well, that's partially because we just elected our conservative government right after the decision was made, right?
Landmarks are like kind of a limited objective that one should be able to accomplish. The landmarks are like a limited objective.
Yeah.
That there should be able to be a specific, and there has been some pressure about that.
Right.
Thank you.
So, maybe it's something.
Oh,
something we can do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your work
is great.
I said the weather. Yeah, that's the only thing.
That's what I would think too. That so many Iraqis are going.
Yeah, it's the same way. Not just the cold and
doesn't end.
Yeah, no, I thought it was like they just had to get out.
Just go. But you know, we want the Canadian government to get out.
Yeah, that's another issue. That's another thing that has to
happen. The 80s is a big one. I mean, you know, that was like the Allende government, no different. A democratically elected government and help the Americans over there.
Right, I know. That's terrible. So you are now in Canada.
We're in Canada. I guess I didn't make that clear enough. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah,
McMaster.
Do you have a card?
I'm really sorry. You know, we're always negligent.
That's right. Let's write down right
down
email.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Ted, you should do that. Here.
Okay. Yeah, here we go.
There you go.
A major reason they came to McMaster was having difficulty in staying. You know, they couldn't get funding.
The Zionist lobby, it won't allow them to do this research, so they've come to us.
They couldn't even submit to the ethics board at Weinstein.
And Weinstein is all Middle Eastern.
So that's why they came to us. So
try to use to push them to give us the location.
Right, and your object is, yeah, so. And so maybe when we respond to the Lebanese government and the funders, that has to be a major push.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that the work that Robert and most people did for Johns Hopkins is extremely important.
It was very good, but you know, it didn't get a lot in the media. Yeah. It was crazy. I was following it just one day. Mm-hmm. It was so important to the Bush that he went and arrested publicly, you know? Mm-hmm. But then the media just kind of,
the media is going to fall into the whole Iraqi war and off. You know, I watch French TV. I can't stand it. I don't even watch CNN.
I gain through the internet, going to different websites. That's how I get to know.
I have friends who watch Al Jazeera.
Yeah.
They say that it's much better.
Oh, Al Jazeera is one of the most independent, actually. Because I have inside information from family, and it's always reflected in Al Jazeera rather than others.
That's why
they wanted the point. It's a pleasure, really. Yes, we will. I was in Montreal years ago. I was in Boston, Harvard. Went there for a visit a few days.
Isn't that a great city?
Yeah.
Well, maybe you could live in Montreal. Montreal's a good place. I have one of my children.
Yeah.
Montreal, yeah. It's where I did my PhD at McGill.
Oh,
Okay, well,
so please
have a nice trip back. Yes, okay. I will email you.
Okay.
Started.
I should have helped you out. Well, I you know, I
didn't. Usually, I hear early, yeah. And I get to make it right up here. And he's a
Yeah, I would say. Very impressive. Very, very impressive. defense contractor. And they did pay me.
Whoa.
And it's like one of these sort of, you know, they got a giant building and they're sort of the, and there were a bunch of these military, you know, not like your shell-shocked mind, but intelligence officer sort of, you know, Dr. Strangelove, you know, target, finding,
type,
you know. It was really... They really hated me, and that was the only consolation. It was a really a dreadful.
Awful.
Well, I went to take pictures, and of course, my batteries were dead.
Thank you. right. Middle Eastern wars and humanitarian catastrophes' role in U.S. Middle East policy in recent history. And you thought it was just about boring public health.